My deepest thanks to Vicente for the wonderful words. I wish my parents could be here to hear all this. And of course to Leandro, who's a fantastic not only scholar in my field, but Leandro Prados de la Escorsota is also known as a tremendous institution builder. Beyond even just his own individual work, he gives selflessly to the entire field of study. Okay, and I don't have to point him out, but I should point these point out what's on the screen at some point. We have an excellent opportunity here to revisit and to learn new things about this subject. The opportunity is actually coming just last year and this year, just 2016 and 2017, because we have suddenly got sort of an explosion of new factual presentations about how societies have been giving, in fact, and redistributing from rich to middle to poor within the income ranks. So I have some ideas here. Oh, good, this is where I wanted to go. I have some ideas that I will think that I can present to you as where we are going now. And they are my ideas, but clearly I'm drawing on the work of others. And you can see here on the screen exactly which others. Right now, we have good photo snapshots. We have like selfies of all the countries of the world, well, 53 of them, as you'll see, which show exactly in today, let's say around year 2007, the extent of this redistribution from rich to middle to poor. And those tremendous new pictures come from two sources. The OECD itself, which is the source of much of my data and has been through much of my career. I've just benefited tremendously from them. Also, a group called the Commitment to Equity Research Group. This is headed by Nora Lustig, una porteña, who's at Tulane, and she has a great grant from the MacArthur Foundation for a whole team of people to study this for countries other than the usual OECD countries. So those are the ones that I'm able to put together for the snapshots for today. And now, I want to think about what's the history of all this? When exactly did this happen? What are the ups and downs of this willingness to redistribute? And for that, again, others have just helped out. You'll see that I'm using two studies in particular of this last year that are very good, and I will add to those as well. In particular, you can see the two on the screen. Again, the team of Thomas Piketty and his collaborators, operating mainly out of the Paris School of Economics, and also a team of three authors from Sweden, one of which is still in Paris, which have superior information. I hope we can get this kind of detailed information for Spain and other countries very soon. What I will do here is to add some more countries. If we have good information on Sweden and the United States, oh, for sure we have to have Britain in there somewhere. So I'll tell you what we don't know about Britain and what might have been the truth. It will turn out that I will establish an entire pattern that's really holding for all countries of the world over this last 100 years. And I will suggest predictions about which forces might be changing this in the near future, these next few decades. Okay, and let me just preview some of my findings. First of all, the progressivity, I will come to define it again a little more technically, but progressivity, where you're giving from rich, using government to redistribute income from rich to middle to poor, is very young. It's only these last 100 years, basically. And it's global. It's happening all over the world to some extent. That is to say, in every country supplying adequate data, this has been happening. Now, it may be, as we delve into the darkness, that we will find that the other countries for which we don't have good data. Maybe things were not so progressive. But that's a first conclusion. Second, this has not been reversed since the 1970s. And why do I say since the 1970s? Well, a couple of things are about interesting about these last 40 years. First of all, we know that overall inequality is rising and getting worse. What's happening to what government is doing about it, which is my topic today? Okay, the other thing is that since the 1970s or since the 1980s, we have, of course, tremendous political discourse with very strong voices from the right saying, we've had to have some kind of retrenchment, and that this is supposedly being achieved in some cases. I want to look at that. Third, I'm going to make things complicated in the middle of the talk and show you that the way we always measure these things is very much too short-term, because if you really want to know the effects of government on inequality, you cannot just talk about what the government did this year. You have to talk about what they've been doing. I'll come back to show you the different ways in which that's true. That complicates things, but it also points us in a particular direction as to how we might think differently about the overall big trend. And then, if I say to you, as back on number two there, that progressivity has not changed since the 1970s, well, we know that inequality has been rising in most countries, especially those that speak English, mainly. Here's a corollary. That rise of inequality must have nothing to do with what the government is actually doing to people's incomes, rich, middle, and poor. It must be the mystery of that and the debates about what is causing that rise of inequality are not explained away by what I'm talking about today. In fact, the problem is made even more mysterious. Okay, finally, there are a number of ways in which you might imagine that this shift toward progressivity might be reversed in the future. I'll explore some of these. Some that you might, or the journalistic accounts have most naturally thought about, I think are not what is going to happen. I have something else in mind. Okay. Okay, finally, now I want to go to the most boring part. I hope it's the most boring part of all of my remarks, because, you know, you always have to kind of clarify a little bit in some technical terms what you're talking about. So fiscal redistribution. I keep using this term, and I'll talk about progressivity, regressivity. Okay, fiscal redistribution is simply the difference between how unequal people's incomes are before the effects of government, in other words, the original sort of gross incomes that you get from the marketplace, and how unequal we are after the effects of government taxes and transfers, health care, etc., all those things. It's simply the difference between the two. Fiscal redistribution is the difference between the before and the after government effects. And progressivity, the term I'll keep using a lot, is simply, as economists have always defined it, a situation in which that is a positive gap. In other words, we are more unequal in the marketplace than we are in what we end up with at home and with public services. That's progressivity. Regressivity is the opposite. The effect of government will make us even more unequal than we were in the marketplace. Okay, and there's another way of defining that. I'll skip that last sentence, which is something that you would discuss in a public finance course. Okay, then, after those boring definitions, some boring or sort of down-putting caveats. Every time people discuss these kinds of measures in the economics of the public sector, they always tell you, well, there's this way of measuring things, which is what we're going to do today, and it's always wrong. It's horribly wrong. It's so bad, it can't possibly be the truth. Okay, so that's the way professors get you excited when you come to this topic. Okay, well, I have four of these kinds of cautions to give you. The first is something I emphasize more than others. There's a serious problem of time horizon. You'll see this again when I come to discuss education and its role. We, in the usual measures, the way people put numbers on these things, usually do not succeed in capturing what happens to a person over their entire lifetime. And in addition, as I will continue to say, you do not follow the lifetime of the policy either, because it goes on, and you are being affected right now in Spain's distribution of income by things that Spain did in 1984, say, or any other past year. I want to worry about the time horizon issues. Second, the one that everybody says, and this is what you get in the economics course about this. Oh, these calculations about the inequality before and after government, they assume that you could redistribute and that it would have no effect on people's behavior. You can take massive amounts from the rich and they would go on doing the same thing they do anyway. Same thing with the recipients. The economists always think that what a terrible assumption, that can't be exactly true. Two other smaller caveats at the end. Remember, there are other ways in which government redistributes between the different income ranks than what you can see in the budget. Those I won't get into much today. But other things, what other things? Well, minimum wage laws, employee protection laws, anti-union laws, all sorts of things have major effects on different groups, but they don't show up in the budgetary measures. And then finally, the materials that we use to write a history of this have their weaknesses. So all these reasons are good reasons to be discouraged about the whole idea of trying to research this. But I'll do what everybody else does too. I'll say, okay, that's true. Now let's go do it anyway. And that's exactly what always happens in the economics courses. The professor has spent a lecture and a half saying you why you can't do this. Now let's go do it and see what information we can get from these numbers. Because usually, hey, the numbers can't be that stupid. Okay, there must be some information out there. Let's explore it. Okay, now our 53 selfies, our 53 snapshots of different countries around the world. Thanks to OECD and thanks to Nora Lustig and her team. Here they are. Now, here's where you can see fiscal redistribution, and you can see how unequally we are before and after government. These measures don't capture everything, but that's okay. Now, how unequal are we? These are Gini coefficients before taxes and transfers. The coefficient tells you if nobody changed their behavior, what part of national income would you have to, that's going to be the gap. I want to come to that third. Okay, this is before and after taxes, just inequality. Oh, I'm sorry, yes, so I was giving the right sentence. If you took the income before taxes and transfers, what share of it would have to be efficiently redistributed from rich to poor by Robin Hood to exactly make everybody equal? That's what the measure is. And then the same thing, well, with what we end up with, we could go for the same kind of measure. Now, if government had no effect on rich, middle, and poor, you would be on this 45-degree line. The two measures would be the same. Okay. Even before I get into specific countries, you can see the first conclusion. Nobody is on that line or above it. There is no country today which has yielded data on these things. There are some secret keeping countries out there, but no country of these 53 that have given us enough data that we can figure it out has failed to redistribute some from rich to middle to poor. That is to say, if you look at it in terms of the diagram, for any amount of inequality before taxes, you end up less equal below the 45-degree line after taxes, and that gap between your dot and the 45-degree line, that is fiscal redistribution. That's my topic. Okay, so let's start where we really must start, which is Spain. Spain is, what a boringly normal country. Spain is just so ordinary, United Kingdom. You know, they're just smack in the middle of everything, of all this global experience right now. And, well, so is the United States, but the United States is a little less, not as generous as Spain or Britain. They're over here, okay? So we're all in the middle. You can see there's some other things going on out here at these ends of things. Latin America has lots of inequality from the marketplace, and the inequality stays. They don't do much about it. Latin America does not redistribute very much. Footnote, I ignore Cuba. Okay, I'm sorry, we don't have the data on Cuba. I don't ignore Cuba, but we don't have the data on Cuba. Okay, so Latin America is in that situation. South Africa is so extreme, is off the graph. In other words, they have horrendous inequality. They actually redistribute quite a bit of it as part of the racial settlement, but they're off the graph. At the other end, Korea and Japan. And if you wanted to look at the economy of Taiwan, I use that phrase, the economy of Taiwan, then you would get the same thing. It's not shown on the graph. But they start out, even in the marketplace, in what people earn, pretty equal. They're not that different from each other. And they don't redistribute much. Okay, so that's kind of the overall tendency. That's interesting. And I'm going to want to explore pretty soon how we get to that point. But let's just kind of dwell on this for the moment, moving that curve to the to your left, and just kind of look at some of those patterns. I've already told you, number one, there's progressivity in all cases. Everybody does some redistribution. You might not know that from the press, but that's true. Latin America and East Asia stand out, as I just said, showing us those two extremes. Now, what's the overall tendency? That is to say, if we looked at countries that were very unequal where people were very unequal in the marketplace, and countries where the same people, households, were very equal in the marketplace, how different would they be in the amount of national income that they redistribute downward from richer to poorer? And you can read on the screen, there are two sort of natural intuitions that people have, and they are opposite, these two intuitions. One is that, I should pause for a second. Total time. Total time should be
around
15, 20, 50? Okay. So I'm watching it. One intuition is that if you get highly unequal incomes with a skewed income distribution with many people at the very top, far richer than anybody else, you would imagine that this puts everybody else in the same mass opposition, and they, in the median voter, will simply grab that money. They will soak the rich. So if you believe that inequality itself creates redistribution away from the rich, you would think this curve should be flat, fairly flat, because no matter how rich they get, they don't end up with that much more than others. There's the opposite possibility. In a society where income is highly unequal before taxes and transfers and things, the rich simply buy the government, and it does their bidding and makes sure that their money is safely with them and never goes to others. That would be what I've called the Robin Hood paradox kind of case that I think it does happen in some parts of the world, whereby they stay with inequality before and after, and in that case, you would get a steep curve, where the really unequal societies stay extremely unequal after taxes, etc., on the vertical measure. As it happens, we get neither of these is particularly well supported in the world global cross-section of today. All we can see is that for these countries that start off with people in the households very equal, or ones with them very unequal, they come out much the same in the extent to which national income is redistributed from rich and poor, that gap. So the whole thing comes out like a 45-degree line. Okay, now OECD researchers are the first to help us where I want to go, as you can see at the top. I want to go back into history now and say, when and where did this change? The OECD people are working on this, and they've taken it back to the 1980s. And what they have given us, and this is coming up soon. What I'm talking about is actually not published yet, but the OECD will publish it later this year, or probably next year. And over the 30 years, from the 1980s to the 2010s, I see in their numbers no change. Things have kind of gone along like this. Now, if you wanted to be pessimistic, here's something you could do with their numbers. You could say, oh, look, the continued rise of productivity happened only from the 1980s to the 1990s. It will look that way in some numbers. And then we've gone backward, you know, back toward the right, if you want to think of a shorthand, a political shorthand, since the 1990s. And the way they are writing their text, the OECD people want to actually describe it that way. There's a little bit of a problem. The 1990s, where this bend happens, giving us no change overall, the 1990s was a case where in Sweden, Finland, many other countries, you had what looked like a lot of progressive redistribution simply because they were so depressed at the time. Their economy was in such bad shape that just automatically they started giving more to the poor, and it wasn't any change in policy. Here you have to confront the fact that when you get into these measures, you would like to know what government is doing with their sort of supply of redistribution. But really, how many people qualify is a huge question. How many people are in need for any given state of government? And in the 1990s, that's really what was going on. I've been talking again a couple times this year with the economists who are presenting these other estimates. We disagree on how to interpret them. I'm using their numbers, but we disagree on the interpretation, and I should say that. Okay. But though the people with whom I've had this disagreement, they also note something else that's behind most of the numbers that we're talking about. They fail to give you what is given to the poor, paid for by some other different taxpayers, in the form of aid in kind. What's the Spanish phrase for not en efectivo, but aid in kind? Aid in kind. And expect, okay, thanks. And when you put that in, that, of course, adds to the progressivity in any one point in time. And what we've got to figure out is how much the expansion of that kind of assistance has actually affected things. Now, to go back for just a second, in these different dots, the failure to include that measure is true of the OECD dots, for OECD countries and communist countries, formerly communist countries. It's not true of Latin America and others covered by Nora Lustig and her group. They did include those transfers. Okay, but now we're going to quickly run out of direct measures of this progressivity, and we're going to try to say, what would shape our guesses about what has happened to it in the past in cases where we don't actually see the direct measure itself, but we could guess. Were things more or less progressive in that situation? Okay. I've looked at correlates. The best one is simply, how big are social spending programs as a share of the national economy? The bigger they are, typically, the more progressive the situation. I will take that idea and make a little bit of use of it, though I'll always be careful to look at the actual history of the individual countries. You can see some such correlation there. It correlates better with that. The progressivity from rich to poor correlates better with the size of social budgets than it does with things on the tax side. I will illustrate that in a moment for the United States, for Britain, etc. Okay, and let's turn first to the United States, where I illustrate exactly that kind of point. So here's the United States. An interesting thing about this measure of this really definitive work now on income inequality and fiscal redistribution in the United States is that none of the authors is actually American. Okay. They're all French or French Basque country border, all three of them. So, but two of them now are actually professors at Berkeley, but they're all, actually, this action comes out of Paris. Okay, now what they have shown you is things you've heard about in, especially in the year 2014, when Thomas Piketty's book, already somewhat noticed in French, was translated into English, then into Spanish and other languages, and caused a great explosion. I mean, it's the biggest publication hit in economics since John Maynard Keynes's The Economic Consequences of the Peace, I think, was another one. It's one of those books that everybody, having nothing to do with the study of economics, says, oh, I've got to read this. I'm sorry. They say, oh, I've got to buy this. And it's one of the most widely purchased books, not so widely read. I've read it all. I've actually read it all. It's a terrific book. Okay. Now, so at the top of the screen, which is not where I end up, at the top of the screen, you get those two big kind of thick curves, which show you inequality before and after the effects of government. They have done both of these. They actually took this measure only back to 1962. But with their data, I could see from other things that I know or make for reasonable assumptions how to generate all of this and to complete their measures back to 1913. So we have 100 years. And of course, you get in those measures what's called, what some of us called the Great Leveling, from the 19-teens to the 1970s. Almost every country has an equalization of incomes. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could figure out a way to do that painlessly and without any political problems? But it did happen, and there's great debate as to how. And then there's widening again, especially for all the English-speaking world, you get this widening back toward inequality. That's the top, that's familiar territory. I'm down at the bottom using their measures to show you how much was redistributed progressively from rich toward poor. That's the green line near the bottom. That's the overall redistribution. And that just kind of marches along. It didn't matter which of those epochs you were in, it just keeps creeping up. And even more recently, when you say you can't think of any program they did to help the poor more, which is true, nonetheless, they, in times of need, they have used existing programs and bent them so that they would, in fact, help the poor more. So, for example, in the Great Recession, which the United States, Spain, Greece, Italy, Ireland and others shared very much. The Americans used their food tax, their food stamp program to give more food and basic income purchasing power to the poor, even though there was nothing that Congress did. Congress hasn't been able to do anything for years. But in fact, the people running the programs were able to get more to them. Okay, so progressivity. It follows that social transfer share. So in the lower part of the diagram, you can also see the other related curve, which is the share of social spending in GDP. That works pretty well with it, though you might want to notice, as I'll come to at the very end, how social spending has crept up more than the actual redistribution of rich to poor. There's something they're doing in these programs that is not helping the poor relative to others. But that's the tendency, and the other curves that I won't talk about much show you ways of looking at what has happened to taxes, and they do not tell us the history very well of redistribution. Okay, this I can go past, except for just to explain one part of the graph. One part of the slide in particular. I'll just stay on the left-hand side of what you're looking at and notice for you that this history now allows you to put numbers on, put magnitudes on how much the attempts to move away from redistribution from rich to poor measure up against the longer history. So we have here, I give you some numbers on Reagan and on George W. Bush, the early part of this century. They indeed did succeed, you can see the minus signs, in reducing progressivity some, which their political base wanted them to do. It is still smaller, much smaller than what has happened over the century, and even with that in the mix, even with those two minuses included, we have this march of up to 9%, 9 Gini points, a considerable rise in progressivity, a considerable tendency toward equalizing incomes through government. Now, I'd like to add Britain, and that's a problem. As the late, great Tony Atkinson and others have found time and again, the British data are so difficult because the British government kept changing how it wanted to collect them, and so it's really hard to compare the different historical periods. But that's okay. If we just think about the overall questions that we have in mind, we still get good answers. I'll start here with what is circled on the right for you, which is the latest data since 1979. Since 1979, the Office of National Statistics has pretty good measures for Britain. And they show you Margaret Thatcher and since Margaret Thatcher. Interestingly, in Margaret Thatcher's case, you have early in her, she starts in 79, early in her regime, progressivity goes up. More is given to the poor from the rich. I didn't remember that in the newspapers. The reason you see that happening is because the labor markets were so badly disrupted by the combination of a recession and what she was doing that people qualified more for public assistance, and suddenly it looks like the government is doing a lot to help the poor. Over her entire regime, you get the negative effect, as shown here. And she did indeed make incomes less equal. That was part of the idea of the program. It's supposed to stimulate the economy, et cetera. Over the entire time period, though, you can see from 1979 on, there's no particular change. Now, I wanted to go earlier than that. What happened earlier? And I'm going to deduce that the overall progressivity gain from over this 100 years has to have been considerable, again, as it was for America. Here's how you do that. See, now the economic historian here is not a government official who has to tell you the best measure. What we can do is we can put bounds on the best measure. We can say, hey, it could not be as large as this, it could not be as small as that. And that's a game you should always be willing to play because it's often the best you can do in a world of incomplete information. So you can see I have a green area here between a top and a bottom set of estimates. The top is it couldn't have been that redistributive and progressive. The bottom is it must be more progressive than the bottom. Okay, so how can I decide on a kind of policy that gives me especially that top bound? I'm going to be especially interested in that. How can I say that, oh, they couldn't have done that much? Well, here's my example. And I draw inspiration from Monty Python's Flying Circus. Most of you are not old enough to have seen the original, but that's okay, it's on YouTube. This is my scholarly citation of a source, Vide YouTube. And it's all there. And in this, the great John Cleese plays this Dennis Moore. He's an 18th century Robin Hood wannabe. He wants to take from the rich and give to the poor. This is his whole mission. And they go through about 7 episodes of this in different weeks. And what he does is he keeps taking from the same rich people and keep giving to the same poor people. So that by the end, as you can see at gunpoint, he's got these formerly rich people in their underwear eating gruel. And then over at the other side of his redistribution, he's giving stuff to the used to be poor people. And they're just so disdainful. This stuff you've been sending us lately is so shoddy. Can't you give us a Vasquez original or something like that? You know. And I don't want to do his exercise exactly because what happens in his exercise is you would never actually change inequality. It's the same Lorentz curve when you're done as when you began. You just changed places as to who was the rich and who was the poor. And in the final episode, subtlety about the Lorentz curve of inequality sort of creeps up on him. Say, blimey, this redistribution of wealth is trickier than I thought. And so we can't use exactly what he did, but on the left here, here's my way of taking the idea. If you were the great redistributor, the great Dennis Moore or Robin Hood, the most you could take from the rich way back in 1911 was what was taken from them in income taxes and wealth taxes. The most you could give to the poor, was taken from anybody in income and wealth taxes, not just from the rich. See, so I've overestimated what you've taken from the rich. And just look at all social programs and suppose that they all went to the very poorest. They did not. That would give me an overestimate of how progressive the system was. And that turns out to be so constrained that what you know is that back 100 years ago, there had to be close to nothing going on. The green area has to be down near zero, okay? And you can do that for many countries. I've illustrated for Britain here, but that's the basic idea, because 100 years ago, as I and others have found, there was almost nothing being done. So this whole idea of societal redistribution toward the poor is young. It's only 100 years old at most. It's actually only 50, 60 years old, but it's only 100 years old at most. Well, for us historians, this is nothing. I mean, this is 0.1 millennia. Angus Madison's guesses are already 2 millennia long and so forth. So it's so recent, all this progressive idea. Okay. And then finally, of the countries to which I will actually have a detail here, there's a great study. I might talk about it differently in a different audience and emphasize some things on the screen here. But basically, for Sweden, we have such good microdata that we can follow people over their entire lifetimes and their entire income history. Sweden, Norway, Netherlands, they have these fabulous microdata sets. I wish we had those. But they aren't, they're not statistical samples. They're in the entire population, you know. So they have very good data, and what they can show you is that for a whole set of people, they follow the people born from 1928 to 1948, follow them all the way up to the year 2009, and what they find is that their income over their entire lifetime is more equal after taxes than before and transfers than before, true, but not by as much as you usually get in all these measures. In other words, over an entire lifetime, people do trade places a lot because some people come, they lose their jobs or they come in and out of the labor force, things like that. And the inequality among us is less over your entire lifetime than it is for any one year. They have interesting results about that. But in particular, I wanted to mention what they get from the annual, the good old classical one-year measurements of what government does to inequality. Again, I will focus on things at the bottom of the graph here, this curve in green. So Sweden is a country that has come away from progressivity somewhat. And here's the way I want to describe it, as shown on the screen, too. Since 1984, they redistribute less now than they did back then. That was an historic peak. 1984 was the most redistributive time in favor of the left coalition, of the Social Democrats and their left coalition partners. 1984, the first of those, you see two little humps toward progressivity there. The 1984 one is the one you really want to remember. Since then, yes, Sweden has retreated from its original progressivity in 1984, which was very high by world standards. They've come back from that. If you think you see a second hump, it's not real. It's not true. It's like that thing about Margaret Thatcher in 1984. The progressivity is not actually true. It's just that the economy is in such a slump that it looks like they were redistributing a lot toward the poor and that they had changed their mind. They didn't. In fact, in the early 1990s, Sweden's government was reforming in a kind of conservative, more pro-market way. They have retreated from this extreme progressivity, but you can also see from the graph they're still ahead of what was true back in the 1970s, and for sure they are far more progressive than they were 100 years ago when they, like everybody else, basically redistributed zero. Okay, that's the Sweden case. Chile, I want to mention too. It belongs in this discussion somewhere because Chile is the most dramatic. If you really want to see a shift away from progressivity and then toward progressivity, Chilean history since Frey, is probably the most dramatic example, aside from communist revolution countries. You know, they went in and out, and that was pretty big, too. But in Chile, I have a different measure. Sorry about that. I can't quite give you the same old changes in Gini's. But for the middle, the rich and the middle and the poor, I'm showing you on the vertical axis what the government is doing to them when you consider everything the government is doing through its budgets. And that has what you might have thought as you go to Pinochet. And after the coup, there is a tremendous shift in favor of the rich, the solid dark line, and away from the other classes. And that is dramatically reversed. Oh, dramatically. These are shares of all of national income. It's not percentage changes in just these groups, which would be more dramatic, but it's shares of all of national income. And to take away from the top one-fifth of society 3% of national income, that's pretty big. So there are these tremendous shifts. Why? Well, in the Chilean case, pensions are a large part of the story. And I want to tell you a little bit about that with the help of my, as I have written with my co-author Leticia Royobad. Chile is famous for having reformed pensions. And the story is partly true. It says, you are forced by the government to save for your own pension spending. True. And that is now having some effect today to make the system solvent. However, you should not think that what the coup did was to get rid of a progressive social welfare system, a social security system, and replace it with this individual savings that are forced by government from above, from central authority. Because there never was in Chile a national social security system before Pinochet. In fact, the common Latin American pattern, including all the countries that tried to imitate what Chile did, they all had the same problem. What they're coming from is kind of the bad history of most countries' pensions history, which is you start with a situation where the government takes all of taxpayers' money and some contributions from the government, the employees affected, mixes it together, and gives it to people at the top. This is a very common Latin American pattern. The people who get the good pensions are all, and it starts from there in the early 20th century and starts to trickle down through society, but the people who get the pension benefits are public sector, like the court system, the military, etc., and the top most favored formal sector people, like in Chile's case, the maritime workers and some of the miners. They get all those benefits. Now, what Pinochet actually confronted at this time was this really bad system. It wasn't some kind of left-wing progressive system. Allende, by the way, as you're reminded here, was hardly in office long enough to ever have had much effect on any of this. And what he actually inherited was a system whereby the privileged classes had not been actually paying their contributions. There was massive avoidance of what you were supposed to have contributed to your own pensions. But you got the entitlements. And he had the political choice of saying, sorry, we're going to mark your pensions down to what you actually contributed. That sounds like the ideological package. Or I will honor all of your pension entitlements, even though you didn't pay for them. He did the latter. He honored them all, massively regressive, because everybody getting this break from the government is at the higher end of society. That has been undone since then, and direct taxes have become greater ever since the return to democracy from Concertación and later governments. Okay, so that's the idea. And I had just been describing that. You get the idea. And my slide showing is now catching up with what I just said. More recently, they have done these things. Okay, now, the other really complicating thing about the way we read what has happened so far is this. This is where I wanted to make things more difficult. The government that is affecting how Spain is distributing its incomes today through government, redistributing, are policies that have been in effect for many years. It's not just what's going on this year. So, for example, all the usual ways of measuring this, including all the data from other people that I showed you, are missing my point. Basically, if you think of something like, say, education, public subsidies to education, what those measures do is they say, they look at the public subsidies to education this year, and they just assign it to the income classes of the parents. So this model of what education is doing to the inequality of us is basically a babysitting model. It's a daycare model. That's really, because it's the parents who benefit, forget the children. Okay, but you are supposed to be equalizing society in some sense in the future when these people come into the marketplace as adults. And in fact, that kind of long-term effect is very important, and I want future research to follow this a lot. I'll only touch on a bit of it today. So here's three big effects you could get into. First of all, the government treatment of non-human capital. Suppose you really taxed the wealth and the capitalists. That's going to affect their future property incomes and their heirs' future property incomes. It doesn't just affect them this year. So follow that, and that's a better way to tell the history. I won't do that today. Both of these are still highlighted in the screen. I will leave that to Piketty and others, because they are the best scholars on that. And the third one, deferred payment obligations, such as public pensions, I come to a little bit at the end, and I'm running short of time. But I want to look at number two right now, human capital, the point I've already been making. Because we now know what is happening to the amount of schooling, the number of years of schooling that adults have ever since 1870, thanks to two Korean scholars. This is part of the original Barrow Lee Educational Attainment Project, and now the Lee and Lee have given us very good measures that we economic historians should run with. Okay, so for any set of countries, I want to show you two things. On the left, you would get what they have shown, which is that, on your left, the average years of schooling of adults. And on the right, I want to show you something that I calculated from their numbers, which is the inequality of schooling of adults as a result of their past enrollments in school. Now, it's funny, it might seem like, I've wandered here, because here I'm looking at actual schooling that people got. What happened to my topic about what government is doing? Not to worry, it's the same thing. Because the rise of average schooling is driven by the rise of primary and secondary education. And the rise of primary and secondary education in every country where it ever improved is done through government budgets. There is no country that has relied primarily on private schooling. You're looking at something that is the result of government budgets on the left-hand side for you. And on the right-hand side, the inequality of it is remarkably related. I'll stay with these five countries for the moment here, just to show you that on the left, you can see, I can see which countries were leaders and which countries had to catch up later on. United States was a leader in enrollments and schooling. Russia caught up, has been catching up. Spain would be something like UK up there, somewhere in the mix. Okay, and on the right, if I look at the inequality of schooling, it's the same rankings. It's like I told the same history upside down, because that's actually what the numbers look like since you first have enough schooling going on in society for anybody to think to measure it. Okay, there's those countries. Just show you how this works for other countries. Here within Asia, same idea. The rankings on the left and the histories on the left of the leaders and followers in average schooling is just like the leaders on the right in getting inequality of schooling down. Japan way ahead, Korea way ahead, India still catching up. And similarly for Latin America, same thing. Cuba and Chile, leading in average schooling, Cuba especially becoming the leader in the Castro era, and on the right, similarly, something about inequality, the Argentina. Some of these series do a couple funny things in the way they do the numbers, but the rankings are all correct. Guatemala is the lowest in schooling and therefore the most unequal in schooling, etc. Okay, now why do you get those international differences? They are a matter of policy. I'm going to just shoot past what's on the screen, but basically it's what you were probably already intuiting when I showed you those graphs. Many countries have a highly elitist policy toward education. To the extent that they provide any, and I'm typically talking about a country that provides small amounts of education, they typically channel their education toward higher education. And we know who gets the higher education. It's not the average random person from the masses. And that is, you know, that's a history that needs to be told more, and I've told it elsewhere. Okay, now, quickly, what's going to change all this in the future? Well, on the one hand, I cannot think of anything that means that we tomorrow are going to have a tremendous surge in Robin Hood redistribution from rich to poor. I can't see anything going on that's going to make that happen. Well, a Great Depression would make it happen, I suppose, but setting that aside, and I don't see any such thing. What could make us turn to the right and go away from progressivity? And I want to tell you some things that are unlikely and something else that I would emphasize. Here are a couple things that are unlikely, and I've already shown you the evidence for the first of these. One idea was that some people might have thought, well, since we see inequality getting worse over these last 40 years, it must be true that this is going to cause more reaction of government will redistribute more of that new income to the poor. Clearly that's not happening. You don't get a net result in that direction, and I've already talked about it. Second, what about immigration and backlash? This is a good natural journalistic connection. We can see these are hot issues, socially divisive issues. Could they not divide us and make us redistribute less toward the poor? To have a bunch of immigrants come in or to have them be shut out by backlash. Okay, I'll have to give just a quick summary here. That will only strain the welfare state and fiscal progressivity in just a few cases, if you think about it. Suppose one case is, oh, there's so much backlash against the immigrants that we absolutely build walls and shut the door. Well, that's not going to strain our redistributive program within the country. Basically, you just took the immigrant problem away in that sense. Or if we get more filtering, we say only those can come in who bring wealth with them and bring skills, etc. Again, there's going to be no strain on the welfare state. In fact, it'll be good for the budgets. A third case, suppose we discriminate against them. Immigrants can come, but their kids are not allowed to go to public schools and things like that. Well, that I suppose would protect the public system from any further budgetary damage. No, it's only in the case that you would rightly worry about, which is the case where you have a lot of immigrants come in, there's some turmoil about it, and you insist on being fair and giving them the same social entitlements as anybody else who is as poor as they are. In that situation, there's going to be trouble for the social budgets and for the fiscal progressivity. That would be true for Germany and Sweden. Let's see what happens with them. The others, I don't see anything like that happening. Now, finally, my idea of the biggest threat to this redistribution from rich to middle to poor is the aging of society. Fortunately, this threat creeps along slowly. It's not going to hit us all of a sudden tomorrow. But it's there. It creeps along slowly, and if the share of national income and government budgets that has to go to the public contributions to pensions keeps going up, something has to give. There is a danger that that will cause you to spend less on the well-being of children and people of working age. I can already show you something like that in this contrast of Latin America from other countries. So you can see the Latin American countries in green. None of them are the top spenders on education per person of school age, which is this upward measure. But they are pretty generous on spending in favor of what goes sideways here, the spending on the elderly per person who is over the age of 65. This is not a measurement of those retired, it's a measurement of those older than 65. Latin America is different from the others in this respect. So for example, you know, Spain and Portugal, I think I've got both, yeah, I've got both of them on the screen. They're more progressive in almost any sense of that term than the Latin Americans who are below them. And there is this peculiarity of that issue for Latin America. More generally, as Leticia and I have said, Latin America stands out as the region of the world that does not invest in its future. So far, Africa as well, but really Latin America is way behind on that. Everything is about today, and they're just not investing. You can even see it in private capital formation issues. So I use Latin America to get into this issue more generally. And for OECD countries, I think I forgot, I don't get Spain identified in there for you, sorry. But how the OECD countries have used their government's social policies to just redistribute differs enormously by age group. If I start off with the elderly here, you have on either axis, it doesn't matter whether you're looking horizontally or vertically, it's just 1995 versus 2005, it's the same behavior. On either axis, in their very interesting graph, they show you, look, these countries all, with their policies and their transfers, eliminate 40% or more of poverty, of the elderly who are in the poverty line. They put them above the poverty line. Good. Success. That's what success would look like. For the working age and the children, there's clearly some countries that are not matching up here. And the United States and Japan are two of them. Italy, on one measure. The memberships in these groups are going to change, but you can see that there's a large share of the community of high-income countries that are simply not redistributing toward, they're already not redistributing toward working age and children, and that's the danger that's coming up. What we've got to have, I'll just go to this this last one here, is that here's where I see some danger. What I've got graphed here is the generosity of support for the elderly relative to the incomes that working people get. And that, and generosity per year, that must be going down. In a good country, that should be going down. Of course it should be going down, because the share of adult life that you spend over 65 keeps creeping up. It cannot be true that what society, or even what you, for your own savings, give yourself in old age, it cannot be true that it keeps pace with your annual earnings in the working population. It can't be true because of the sizes of the groups are shifting. Something has to give, okay? And if I look around here, I want to say, oh, who's doing a good job of getting this curve to go down? Well, my little X's for Sweden, oh, that looks pretty good since the reform of 1998. Sweden maybe is doing the right job. Nobody else is doing it. Everybody else is having their generosity of pensions and the public contributions to pensions keep up with the general wage rates, etc. That cannot continue. It shouldn't continue. After all, if you think of it, what should you offer elderly people? Well, a certain amount of resources based on what they had earned and things. But you should offer it over their entire elderly lifespan. And the more years that is, the less you should be offering every single year. There's got to be, something has to give. So there are a few cases, but that's my final message. Something has to give there. And that could damage the budgetary ability to help out progressivity among the younger age groups. Thank you.